And because, you know, these airports are doing amazing things.
Let's go ahead and call the March 5th meeting of the Mill Creek City Council to order, and we will begin with the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mayor Pruitt?
Yeah.
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw? Councilmember Bond?
Here.
Councilmember Todd?
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari?
Here.
Councilmember Steckler?
Here.
Councilmember Vignell?
Here.
First up is audience communication. Do you want to talk to the council tonight? Going once, twice? Okay, we'll come back to that later. New business, the Adopt-A-Ship program. Bob?
So, Mayor and Council, last council meeting, Councilmember Steckler and Councilmember Bond suggested that the council have a discussion about adopting a ship, and this would be a ceremonial action by the council. And so we provided some information for the council to consider, and would be glad to address any questions that council might have. But a simple motion of adoption would be all that would be necessary, and then staff will coordinate activities along, I presume, with council and maybe other volunteers, too, in regards to hosting sailors and others from the ship.
Let me start. Why don't I start? Because I asked Councilmember Bond and Chief Owen, who's also joined us, please feel free to speak up in addition. This was an interesting experience going out onto the ship and meeting the crew, and I didn't really quite understand what they meant about the ship. Why would we do that, and don't they take off? And, you know, I was a little bit confused about it. But as I understand, the ship is based here, and it was a program that they'd done in other cities, and it was interesting. The first meeting that we had in the commander's quarters, it was, okay, so we're going to do an adopt-a-ship program. What do you want from us? And the commander came back with, well, start with, what do you want from us? You know, it's a two-way street. And so we started talking about, it's really a unique opportunity to give these people that some are away from home, and some of them are actually Mill Creek residents, but they're stationed on the ship. But it's a chance to go that one step beyond, you know, when you say to somebody, thank you for your service. Now you get to actually, you know, do something about it. You adopt them, and what that would entail is if there's events here in the city, parade, Veterans Parade or Memorial Day Parade, we would ask them to come and send representatives and and the ship itself is a fascinating ship. It's named after a private Vietnam War that, you know, was a grunt, as they called him, threw himself on a bomb and saved two other Marines. And you know, they don't name ships after privates. They just don't do that. They name them after generals and big-time heroes and names and everything else. And so it was. I kind of got into the whole spirit of it. Then one of the questions I had was, well, what about when Thanksgiving comes? Could we maybe, you know, invite those sailors that have nowhere to go to come to home? And at that point, the actual, I think it was the superior commander or whatever it was, the other guy came in, and who hadn't heard that, and he said, well, one of the things we do in other cities is we do Thanksgiving, where people invite our sailors into their home. So we went, yeah, we just talked about that. So that's about the only specific thing that was an involvement on the part of the city. And then you have to say, well, could that fall flat? I mean, would our citizens of Mill Creek want to open up their homes to, you know, a couple of sailors they don't know? I think they would. I know I would, personally. Happy to. In fact, I think it's kind of a neat experience to have that. Could be other events, other holidays. It's a unique, different relationship, and I understand that. So that's why I wanted us to have a discussion. I want other council members to feel free to, you know, voice questions or why would we do this or what are the pitfalls of it. But myself personally, I really became a supporter of it after I've seen big ships. I've been on big ships. That wasn't the part. It was just seeing the crew and taking this to the next step, a more personal level and a personal relationship with someone who has chosen to do service work and I'd like to see us. I think it would be a really great community involvement. That's the end of my statements. You guys want to add anything else?
Sure. So,
It would be appropriate if it was Black History Month because Private Ralph Johnson happened to be a man of color. And there was more to the war story here. And I heard it told, and then I read it. And I just want to add, because you did it, but you gave it, leaving the less than the Reader's Digest version. This was a big battle. And he and a couple other Marines were at the rear making sure nobody come in the back door there. And so when the battle, and they were just crushing the enemy. They were holding it, and the enemy could not make any progress to the front. And so they decided this wasn't working, and they went to sneak around to the rear. And had they killed these three men, that sneak attack, that rear attack, would have progressed and been undetected in the fog of war, if you will. But because he saved the two, not only did he save their lives, they were able to alert the forces to what was going on in the back and prevented any other loss of life. That was the only soldier lost in this battle because of him, and they believe it could have been way, I mean, we don't know how bad it would have been, but they believe it would have been a tremendous opportunity for the enemy to kill a lot of people had those three guys died instead of one. So the two not only survived, they alerted the others. The whole battle was not, the enemy did not prevail. And we lost one person there, I believe, and that was this hero. So, as many of you know, I have a son in the Navy. He's in the Naval Academy on the West Coast, $800 flight, 5 hours away. I don't get to see him much, but he was adopted by a family over by Annapolis, and they take him out paintball, and they make sure he gets weekends to just go crash somewhere or whatever. And my family has benefited directly from a program similar to this that allows my son, my 23-year-old, in the Navy, serving on the other side of the United States, a better quality of life because some folks reached out and adopted him. And it's different, but it's similar. And so I thought it would be something I would be willing to give back to and want to do whether we do anything or not. There might be some opportunities even if we, for whatever reason, didn't pursue this. But there's no cost to it. It seems, you know, the ship's going to be gone, so it's going to be opportunities. It's in town. It's a holiday. They're in town on the holiday. These are these chances to reach out and provide some support to these young men and women that are serving in our Navy.
Chief Allen? I'd like to add just something the XO shared with us when we were on board is they have a number of sailors from the Ralph Johnson who are Mill Creek residents who live in our town, singles, couples. And in addition to that, the base commander lives in Lake Stevens. The base XO lives just outside of town. And he shared with me the same thing, not only with the Ralph Johnson, but there are a bunch of sailors that are assigned to Naval Station Everett that are our community members that live in our city. And so for me, that was just one extra piece, I think, that helps kind of make this more attractive and make it more of a family approach. And I thought that was just a cool aspect to it. It was a fantastic presentation by the ship captain.
Thanks, Mayor. Is the mic working?
It doesn't seem to be.
Okay,
so is the red light on?
Barb, see, it's not me.
Turn your red light on.
It is on. I'll talk as loud as I can.
I wholeheartedly support this. I think it's great. I think the more we talked about it, the more kind of excited I got about it, simply because there were no, I guess, set parameters. It was kind of it's evolving as you go, and we don't know what we're going to do, whether we're going to have them over for the holidays or make them baskets with the youth groups before they go on deployment. I mean, fun things like that. It's a chance to start something new, creative, and just a lot of fun. And so thank you, Councilmember and Vaughn, for stepping up and being the liaisons. Appreciate that. And I fully support this. Thank you.
I think this is a good idea, but only if we live up to the list of things that are here. Is that we can't you know, I know that sometimes we go, well, I have to work. Well,
we're saying here that we're going to do something. And I just want to make sure that if we do this, that we don't let these young people down. My best friend's son just left the Navy. My father was in the Navy. Other relatives that were in the Navy. I think it's a good idea, but not if we're going to do it. We have to staff to do this. This is our project, and that we have to do it. So as long as everybody, that's what their plans are, then I think it's a good idea, but not to do this and let anybody down or expect staff to pick up our workload. So do we have a motion? Your motion would be to, ceremonially adopt?
Has the question's been answered for this? Is this enough to move forward, or are you just wanting a motion to move forward on it?
So we have the motion, and the motion is to be ceremonially
about the USS Ralph Johnson.
Okay. Also, before I make that motion, I just want to make sure everybody knows, John Raymer, was a big part of bringing this to our attention, creating the tour, and bringing this opportunity. So I want to make sure he's recognized for this, too. So make a motion to accept and move forward on the Adopt-A-Ship program with the USS Ralph Johnson.
Second.
A motion and a second. Any further discussion. A
lot of it is just letting them know about the events we've got in town. We've got a lot of events in town, so if they just know there's this parade, or they know there's this extravaganza or the drunk or treat, I think that's a lot of it. But I think it's also going to be up to us to notify the community there's opportunities to adopt them for Thanksgiving dinner or whatever. You know, if I'm not in town, I can't invite them to Thanksgiving dinner, but other people hopefully will do that. I think there's other opportunities out there, too. Have a beer with a sailor thing that goes on. The Navy League runs that on every third Thursday. If you want to get up close and personal with these kids, young men, young women, that's a lot of fun, too. I met one last week who's Montero. I was surprised, but just like somebody said, there's a lot of these people that decided to live here either in rental housing or in single-family homes, so I'm all for this. Thanks.
So this will be an exciting evening, Mayor, I guarantee it. It's an overview of bond financing. We have Jim Nelson, who's with the Senior Vice President of D.A. Davison, bond underwriters for many municipalities in this state. Jim's also a resident of Mill Creek for at least the last 10 years, I understand. And so I worked with Jim in the past, and tonight is just an overview of the financing process. Soon we'll be coming to you to issue debt associated with the surface water bonds that we talked about when we adopted the budget. And so tonight's just the first introduction to that process, and I'd invite Jim to the podium, and he's going to give you an overview with the PowerPoint presentation tonight. Very exciting PowerPoint presentation.
I'm on the edge of my chair already. I'm ready.
Yes.
Thank you, Bob. This is exciting for me because of all the city council meetings I attend, fire district commissioner meetings, county commissioner meetings. This is the only one I can say I'm a resident of the city of Mill Creek. So, but I've been here now 18 years. The last time the city issued debt, it was in 2001, and one of the council members said there's 5 years remaining on a refinancing bond. They said, are you going to live in Mill Creek for at least 5 years? And I said, yeah, I'll be here 5 years plus. And so we love this community, schools. This is great. So I am known as a bond underwriter. I work with a large number of municipalities all over the state of Washington, helping them plan for a bond, everything from policies, establishing a bond rating grade, looking at all the different options, whether it's a non-voted bond, voted bond, water and sewer revenue bond. So as I go through this, let me know if you have any questions at all. You know, this first slide is on the overview of the financing process, and basically it's where you look at all the different capital improvements. When you issue tax-exempt bonds, you can only use those funds for capital improvements. The IRS says you must have an intention to spend the money within 36 months. So there's the what we call the bundling concept. If you can bundle multiple financing needs into one financing and pay financing costs one time as opposed to multiple times, that'll save you money. But you prioritize the projects. From there, you determine what you can afford, and then we start in on the financing process. And there's a bond attorney that's involved that makes sure you go through all the legal steps so that they can give an opinion that indeed the bonds are issued and they're tax-free, tax-exempt. From there, we market the bonds to investors, sell about 80% of the bonds, set the interest rates as low as we can while still taking orders for the bonds, and then deliver the bond proceeds 100% upfront money to you. So if you're issuing $3 million, you get $3 million upfront. That is can be invested during the construction period. There's all sorts of rules on that. And then your intention is to spend the bond money in a 36-month period. After 36 months, if you have unspent bond proceeds, then you have to make sure you yield restrict it so that you don't have the IRS come knocking at your door. That's the process. This next one talks about, well, some of the same things. You'll see here, I think, in the next few weeks, there's a reimbursement resolution that I think it's likely that you'll adopt. And that's what we call a safety net. If you're spending money today or here in the near future on capital improvements, then you can adopt that reimbursement resolution. It doesn't commit that you have to issue the bonds, but it gives you that flexibility. If more than 60 days has expired from the date that the check goes out the door for a capital improvement and you don't have a reimbursement resolution, then you lost the opportunity to replenish your cash with bond proceeds. So that's probably my number one advice. It doesn't cost you anything to have that reimbursement resolution. And again, when you issue $10 million or less in a calendar year, it's known as a bank-qualified issuer. That's a lower interest rate. Historically, it's been lower by a quarter of a percent. So that's something to plan for if you're a municipality that's looking at a number of projects that possibly might exceed that $10 million figure. Of the types of bonds, an unlimited tax general obligation bond is known as a special excess bond levy, something the school districts do a lot. For cities, a lot of times we'll see public safety projects. There's a limited tax general obligation bond secured by the general fund, and typically you'll see like a city hall project or maybe equipment purchases. You use limited tax general obligation bonds. And then water and stormwater. Your sewer services are covered by two special districts, Alderwood Water and Wastewater and Silver Lake Water and Sewer District. But for the water and stormwater, that's secured by the ratepayer revenues, and that would be known as a revenue bond. And then a local improvement district bond, which is really interesting. By law, a local improvement district bond or a local improvement district is going to increase the property values, for, such as sidewalk improvements, street improvements. And then the property owners have the option to either pay off their assessment or maybe finance it over 15 years. But by law, that assessment cannot exceed the special benefit. So it's a really interesting financing. After the 2008 economic downturn, we didn't see many local improvement districts. Now we're starting to see them come back with the increase in real estate values.
If you go back to the revenue bonds and the ones beneath them, the local, are they also have the option of voted and non-voted?
No. Well, the revenue bonds, I'll show you the debt capacity in a second, and that'll probably be your next question. Back in the 1960s on revenue bonds, when cities were being formed, then they would go to the voters for utility improvements. But we rarely see municipalities go to the voters for a revenue bond. So now to direct your question more, when you look at number one, general purpose capital improvements with voter approval, 2.5% of your assessed valuation in that particular year, your current total debt capacity is $103 million. You don't have any outstanding debt. Without a vote, you can go up to about $61.9 million. But then we say you have to look at the affordability analysis, because if you were to issue $61.9 million, all that would be paid out of the general fund. So if you issue too much non-voted debt, then you know you may have to cut staff and things like that. So that's a careful analysis, what we call the affordability analysis. Parks and open space, to go to the voters, you can look at something like that. That's $103 million. It's interesting. They changed the laws and added community center and facilities for economic development. So an example is in Leavenworth, their festival hall. The voters approved that. And then the utility purposes. So it's listed there, but I have it kind of in gray and fading because we really don't see municipalities going to the vote for a revenue bond, because you can just issue revenue bonds. I'll show you some examples. I work with Snohomish County Fire District Number 7. They've financed all their capital improvements with non-voted bonds. Their current rating grade is AA. Mukatea Water and Wastewater is at AA+. City of DuPont, another master plan community, their current rating is AA+. And they've financed a civic center and public safety building. And then Sideview Metropolitan Park District is a real interesting metropolitan park district that's issued a combination of voted and non-voted bonds for various improvements. And they just received voter approval in November, this last November, for $15 million. What's changed since 2008? 2008, with the economic downturn, a number of the banks went to the sidelines, and now what we've seen in the last few years is they've come off the sidelines and they've priced what we call direct placements very aggressively. So now it's become our standard practice. We do a lot of public bond sales, but if a municipality is looking at 15 to 20 year financing, we always check the banks to see, you know, how they compare and which one is more cost effective, and then that's what we would recommend to you. We had talked earlier about the public bond sale. We prepare documents known as the preliminary official statement, the final official statement, and a rating presentation. You get rated, then the bonds are sold to the public, or you go out and there's a direct placement to a bank through an RFP process. Here you can see on slide 7 the rating grades. Again, we feel that the higher the rating grade, the lower the interest cost. We feel that you would be somewhere in the high investment grade category or possibly higher. But there's a number of municipalities from Snohomish County, City of Linwood, City of Bothell, Monroe, Mukatea, and others that are in the high investment grade category. So I think with your local economy and above average economic statistics that you should at least fall into the high investment grade. We talked about key factors, looking at your economy, top 10 employers, top 10 ratepayers, looking at your financials, debt, you don't have any, and then also looking at management factors as far as how does council and staff communicate, how are your audits, budgeting, and then what kind of policies do you have in place? That's become a real hot button for the rating agencies. Here's the interest rate market. Surprisingly, we saw interest rates come down in November and December, which really bucked the trend. Part of that was with the volatility in the stock market, and also the volume of bonds were down. I always get the question, where are rates going? And that's a tough call this year. Some are saying that they're going to continue to go up. Others are saying, well, we'll have to wait and see how the trade deal with China fares out. And the bond market seems to like bad news. A lot of times when there's bad news, interest rates will go down. So we'll just see. One of our analysts was saying that if the China deal can be accomplished, that interest rates would probably increase a little bit. If it's not accomplished, then it could put downward pressure on the rates. We also talk about market timing, and part of that, too, is to prepare for the market. If rates are trending down, then you can push out the sale date and hopefully capture some lower rates as the market's going down. So now we get into the numbers, and the bottom line here is that if you're looking at a 15-year financing, see if I can get the pointer to work, you'd want to look at this 2.81% with the bank. $228,000 compared to a 20-year financing public bond sale. It's a 3.2. You go over here and look at a bank, 20-year financing, 3.63. So some nice savings with the public bond sale. But then compare a 15-year public bond sale to a 15-year bank sale and or private placement. And the bank financing is, you might say, easier on staff and it can be accomplished faster. But it also depends on if you can afford that payment. So the reason I click on the limited tax general obligation bonds, Bob Stowe asked, well, could we consider possibly using non-voted debt capacity for the water and surface water improvements? And that is an option for you because you currently have $61.9 million in non-voted debt capacity. From an investor standpoint or the bank standpoint, they would look at the security as the general fund, but from a budgeting standpoint, the money would come from the ratepayers, water and surface water revenues, and replenish the general fund. So it's a good question, and by issuing limited tax general obligation bonds, it does lower your interest rate by about 0.10%. But if you did a revenue bond, to be conservative, we assumed a bond reserve fund, which is equivalent to 1 year's payment, where you have to fund up 1 year's payment. The market's starting to lean away from that, but you've never issued revenue bonds before, so we thought, to be conservative, we'll include that reserve fund. But if we look at the bottom here, you can see a 20-year LT, limited tax general obligation bond, versus a 20-year revenue bond has a difference in the annual payment of about $14,685. 15-year has a difference of about $21,515. So right there, that shows you that if you're comfortable with it, a limited tax general obligation bond structure, whether it's a public bond sale or a private placement, would certainly save money for the city. I guess any questions on this slide?
I'm seeing a recommendation of the value. So it's saying you're going to save 14 by having an election.
No, these are what we call these are non-voted limited tax general obligation bonds. So really, what you're doing is you're using up, say, approximately in this scenario, you're using up, you know, $2,800,000. We'll just round it up to $3 million of non-voted debt capacity. I spoke to another city today. They have $7.5 million of non-voted debt capacity, and they're looking at a $5 million project similar to yours. And I said to them, "Yeah, that's just cutting it too close." And so they'll do it all as revenue bonds.
So I heard a number, and I don't know if it's still accurate, that when we put something on the ballot, it runs around $8,000 to $10,000. And I don't think that's just the cost to go to the county without any calculations of the impact to staff. I mean, as we're looking at the savings, that's a piece of it, too.
Yeah, it could be, but this would not be a voted debt issuance. This would be a councilmatic debt, if you will. You'd be able to issue that. Well, this LTGO is not comparing the voted debt against the – it's comparing a councilmatic debt you would issue versus a revenue bond.
Right.
Not a voted debt versus a non-voted debt. So nowhere are we proposing a voted debt. That's right. Neither of them you have to vote on. By using the LTGO, you are using $3 million effectively of capacity, of which, what was the number for LTGO?
61.9.
Of $61.9 million. So if you anticipate $50 million of something else, that might be cutting a little close to use $3 million of it now. But given the likelihood of that not occurring, it's probably worthwhile to save the $21,000 by going forward with the LTGO.
Good question, Bob. It gets confusing on all these different ones. And this just shows, you know, when you go back to the previous page and look at the red arrows, this shows the annual payments and the net borrowing costs with all fees for a 20-year public bond sale. And you can see average annual payment is about, you know, just under $190,000 a year. And then you've got a private placement here, 15 years, and an average annual payment of about $228,000. So when we look at this difference rounded to roughly $40,000 a year, you know, that's the question, I think, to go back to the rate consultants with FCSG and say, okay, could we afford this or not as a 15-year structure? And I'm just using the $2.8 million example, but, you know, we'll get into some other numbers. This shows, and this is my understanding of this, this is how FCSG sort of laid it out, is that 2019 you would fund $1,300,000, 2021 $1,100,000, and that's it, you know, 2019 $1.3 million, 2021 $1.1 million, and then 2023 $400,000. Totals up to $2,800,000. If you just did one bond issue, the difference in costs is about $29,126. And then the annual difference is about $7,000. But the question then is, how does that fit with your rate structure? And, you know, could you do all $2,800,000 at once? And it sounds like from the feedback it would be pretty tough for staff to do that. But my suggestion would be at least consider combining the $1,100,000 in 2021 with the $400,000 in 2023. This $400,000 piece, in a sense, is penalizing you because it's such a small amount to borrow, but you can see what happens to the what we call estimated all-in true interest cost. Here's, you know, we're assuming that rates go up 0.40% every 2 years, and now you see the net borrowing cost, $290 in 2019, 3.33% 2021, 4.8 in 2023. Well, this is overstated because the costs are applied to such a small amount at $400,000. So it really would be, you know, and that's something that I can work with staff and FCSG. Like one option might be that you don't have any principal payments the first 2 years of this 2021 bond would be interest only, and then that might help sort of ease the payments in as far as the ratepayers are concerned. Sorry, I'm getting into technical jargon here. I'm almost done. And that's pretty much it.
I guess one of the questions is what's more important to us, the payment or the cost of the money?
Right, right.
And I don't know which is, me personally, how would it be the cost of money? The payment, I mean, we've got to get increased fee.
Cost controls, we don't need that money all up front. In fact, we don't need it really for a while. So borrowing it all, you know, is a lower overall cost, though, of the money. I mean, right here, we're looking at, what, about $700,000 right there. That's a lot. That's an awful lot. Yeah, that's an awful lot.
And you weigh that to, if you get all the $2,800,000 up front, is it a reasonable expectation that you can spend it in a 36-month period? And if it's not, then it's probably safer than to do maybe two bond issues, one in 2019, the other could be in 2021 or 22. And then at least you're minimizing some of those financing costs and doing two separate financings as opposed to three separate financings.
When the small pipe research comes out, we might not be meet what our situation is there. That might help us actually need more money and being able to go through that, and the fee increase within the first 36 months might not be a problem for us. We don't know the small pipe.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Outside of the 2.8 million, there's a more.
Oh, there is. Okay.
Coming down the road, yes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But I think that covers it. You're all doing a great job. It's I'm looking forward to these days. Not to sound like a promoter of debt, but when you do finally do a public bond sale, I think it'll be pretty exciting because we feel pretty strongly that you would be somewhere in like the AA range, and that's quite an accomplishment for a city of this size.
So, in the discussion we had with FCS a while back, drove us to help guide us too, that spreads out over time. And you point out that you get multiple issues dedicated at the cost on that. My assumption, though, was that when you were talking about revenue bonds, and if you're talking LPGO bonds, they don't have to only be stormwater projects. Now, this could be some other projects.
That's true. Yeah, you could combine them, and we would create separate schedules for you. So, like, let's say you did decide to do one bond issue for stormwater for $2,800,000, but then you had some police vehicles you're going to buy for $500,000. Maybe that would be financed over 5 years. And then you had some parks projects, say, for $1,000,000. Then we would create three separate schedules, combine all three, and then that would be what would be financed or sold as bonds.
You're my thought. This opens a whole can of worms, but we were talking last week to a great extent about spine road pieces. You know, it's already a spine road piece within our future, whether it is or not. But that could be something we also could wrap into this bond. And so, therefore, you've got some stormwater needs in the first thing of 1.3, and the second thing is $3 million that's a spine road and some stormwater or whatever. And we have an opportunity to move the money around to make our financing costs appropriate and combine multiple kinds of things, not just stormwater projects, maybe really that we do.
And then the other nice thing going with LTGO is you don't have to fund a bond reserve fund. So I need to check in with the FCSG folks and let them know that that's kind of a trend now we're seeing in the market for established revenue bond issuers, that you no longer need to fund that bond reserve fund.
Okay. Any other?
Right. I'm known for asking more and more questions.
I don't really understand
a lot. I need to go back. Could you help me out? Because I think it's important that I totally understand this. Reimbursement resolution?
Oh, yeah.
Let me go back over that again. I just want to make sure I understand that correctly, because I'm a little confused as to what that entails.
So it's I think right now I saw a draft reimbursement resolution for the city. The number was blank. And it talked about, it describes the project, and then it talks about, I think there might be an expiration term on it of like 3 years. But what it means is that as a council, you adopt a reimbursement resolution. It doesn't commit that you have to issue bonds, but it gives you that flexibility. And so the key statement there from an IRS standpoint is that if Peggy cuts a check for capital improvements, say all of a sudden you buy a piece of property, and now more than 60 days has expired from the date the check went out the door, and you don't have a reimbursement resolution, so you've lost that opportunity to replenish whatever fund that is. So it's a great safety net. We used to see years ago fire districts get tripped up because all of a sudden there would be a great piece of property for that future fire station when they go to the voters. They'd buy it, and then a couple years later they'd call me and say, can you help us with planning for a voter bond? And, oh, by the way, we want to, you know, add this capital expenditure on there. And we'd say, did you adopt a reimbursement resolution? If the answer is no, then they would find another way. But it's just, so I usually say it's kind of one of the first things to approve if you're thinking about a project.
So in this case, this would be, staff might love the consultant to start work on design for or investigation of what the pipe issue was. We might not issue the bond for 6 months from now, but if we have this reimbursement resolution next week, then we have that 6 months worth of starting collecting receipts that we would eventually be able to use that bond, because we would wrap up all those costs.
Exactly.
Right.
Yep.
Because it's going to take us
spend the money months and months in advance. It's 60 days from the date the money was expended by us. The money was expended by the bond to us. From the date, 6 days from the date, we get the money.
60 days. Well, so once you adopt a reimbursement resolution, then going forward, you have all capital improvement costs covered. You can go back and definitely pick up all soft costs with consultants and things. But, and then you can go back 60 days from the date that you adopt the reimbursement resolution and pick up any capital hard costs. But if more than 60 days has expired, either from the date that the check went out the door or when you adopt that reimbursement resolution, then you may have lost some opportunity to be able to reimburse capital costs from a future bond.
I understand the percentage savings from the 20-year to 15-year on the cost of the money. I understand the payments, but the cost of the money. Are we saving what percent cost?
Were you talking about this page?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, this is page 10, and I can. That's Gina. How do I turn it back on? There you go. Okay, here we go. Page 10. So the difference there has to do with the net borrowing cost, all the fees, 15-year financing, because it's a shorter term, the interest rate is lower, similar to a 30-year mortgage versus a 15-year mortgage. But because you're financing the same amount, you know, you're funding $2,800,000 in the construction fund, then you're going to have higher annual payments with a 15-year financing versus a 20-year financing. That's correct. Yeah. Not to get into technicalities, but probably your next question is, well, I understand private placement, $2,835,000, subtract out costs of roughly $32,000, and you get your $2,800,000, but I don't understand how you can issue a 20-year bond at $2,625,000 and get $2,800,000. I refer to it as the new math. But it's a function of the market and what we call original issue premium from investors. So investors are willing to pay more than 100%, maybe pay like 110 or 115%. So when you add in that premium from investors, subtract out the costs, then you get to that
$2,800,000.
Yeah, thank you all. Any other questions?
So the next meeting, you're going to get the reimbursement resolution, and then we'll have at least one or more meetings as we look towards approving the first contract for the surface water. Once we have those bids, we'll be able then to finalize the bond costs. And so over the next several months, you'll be receiving more information from staff as we prepare to issue debt either through private financing or through a public bond sale. But next week, the next step will be the reimbursement resolution.
Not at this time. We don't have a contract with any consultant to assess the small pipes yet. So my focus right now is on getting the F failures advertised. Concurrently with that, I am working with Petit on a scope and fee for the small pipes. Which could be parallel to it, but the focus is advertising the F failures.
As far as what I would do on the financing,
yeah.
If you could afford it, I like the idea of issuing a limited tax term obligation bond because you have what we call surplus debt capacity. It's going to lower your interest rate, but then it's a question going back to FCSG if that fits with the if you can afford the 15-year payments. If not, then you could do a 20-year limited tax term obligation bond. Again, you'll save money because you're using non-voted debt capacity.
All right, thank you.
Anybody else?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Jenny is going to lead this study session topic.
Good evening, Council. I'm going to move the podium a couple inches, marks up the microphone.
So I'm going to reach out with this discussion because back in December, as we were looking at Mill Creek Sports Park user rates, this was a topic of conversation that we were asked to come back and discuss with the council. We are right now gearing up for Little League season for 2019. We've been asked about a contract battle, so the timing of this is really important as we move forward to figure out what the council's role is in terms of setting our concession rates moving forward. So a little bit of history, the Mill Creek Little League began using our concession stand. We were the only user of the stand back in 2004, and we have a list in this document of all the rates over the years. It originally was set up as a 20% cut of the gross revenue every year, and a couple of years into the contract, we decided that's not going to work, and we reduced it, the council reduced it, down to 15%. We also pay a $50 per month utility fee, and because, to be clear, the gross revenue at 15% is only for 5 months of the year. So it's March through July, the months when we're actually using the concession stand regularly. Then in terms of storage, because they have a lot of equipment and shelving and everything else that they're storing in the concession stand, we are charging them a $50 per month fee just to store it in the off season, so from August through through February again. So the cost really relatively isn't that high over the course of the year for Little League in terms of looking at storage rates and whatnot. As a result of their use of the concession stand and storing stuff there year-round, we do not allow anyone else to use the PA system because it would mean going through their stuff to get up to the PA system. They have taken up a lot of storage within the facility itself. So as we move forward, it is our recommendation to maintain the status quo in terms of that 15% cut on their gross revenue, but we are open to discussion and questions on this topic.
That's been in place since 2004. 7.2 to the concession stand. I hate to put it this way, but 4. I was trying to the concessions as their fundraiser to support their organization. So it comes out of one hand, goes into the other. They just end up paying for it in dues. But they pay rent, right, based on the field usage charges that we just adopted. Do we have any numbers on what that amounts to for their season?
Not off the top of my head, no.
So how often do we clean the bathroom in the concession stand? Daily? Every other day? Weekly?
Probably weekly or as needed.
Okay.
Not daily.
Is there any other...
So the staff is up there daily, pretty much.
Are they? For the concession stand or for field maintenance as well? I'm just...
At least for the bathroom.
Oh, yeah, for the bathroom and the concession stand. But that, I assume that's... Or is that separate from the... I guess the bathroom would be open any, regardless of whether they use a concession stand.
Correct. Just like our other parks that have restroom facilities.
Yes, I'm trying to figure out why are we charging a percentage of what they sell to use it? If this doesn't cover the cost of, initially I was thinking, well, let's charge them a cost to what it costs us to cover to maintain the concession stand. But is there any maintenance of the concession stand? If the bathroom's separate, what is the cost of the city to maintain the concession stand?
I don't know about the day-to-day, but I do know, for example, at the end of this last season, our maintenance crew spent extensive time cleaning grease off the floor, that the cement is a completely different color because of the amount of grease in the facility. So there are deep cleaning charges that our staff undertakes at least at the end of every season, plus I think just regular maintenance of a facility that we have.
Fire.
Well, and rebuilding after a fire a couple years back.
This goes way back, and Mark can help me with the history. I was in the Parks Board and then on council when this came through here. So the original discussion, but correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, was that the original design was to have a bathroom building in our park. There was a field, and it was a skateboard park, and it was a bathroom building. And through desires of the community, the addition was to put in a concession stand and to put in a announcer booth with a PA system upstairs. And so it was approximately $200,000 difference, was my recollection at the time, to say instead of going from our original building to make it this bigger, better thing that had these extra facilities, another couple hundred thousand bucks. So I think the clause about reimbursement was in the mindset of, oh, extra cost, extra capital costs in the first place went into this, and so therefore users of that space probably ought to be contributing towards that extra space. The 20% came about because staff at the time checked around and said, what is a way to do the revenue, the rental charge for things like this? And at the time they found that that was 20% was a number that was common in other cities and jurisdictions. They set it at 20%. There was a lot of trouble in the first couple of years on terms of how to decide the 20%. And so I think some changes were made in the rate and some changes in the process. The first year it was famously celebrated that Little League unfortunately just had, here's a box of receipts. It was a shoebox full of receipts. Staff, go for it, add them up and tell us what 20% is. And so staff wasn't very happy with that, both finance and parks. And so the process changed. That's why they got to a system of, you guys make a payment based on last year's and we'll adjust at the end of the season, but you, user groups, have to tell us what that is and certify that that's what it is. We're not going to do the accounting for you. So that's all the dirty history I remember from the past. Using it or able to use it now because of this year-round storage of the Little League's facility. So I think that's what staff, I think that's where the charge came from. Thanks.
But I don't mind what we have here. It's not exactly consistent with some of my premises, which would lead me to a slightly different ending. So here's my premises. Little League's good for the community. It's expensive. And it's worth doing something to contribute to it, i.e. build a great big beautiful field and put lights and let them play. The PA, the concessions, I don't see an interest in making money off that for the city. I would rather not lose money. So if it was me, I would sit down with the Boy Scouts and or the Little League and I would say, you clean this thing and we're not going to charge you $500, or we'll come in and professionally clean it and get the grease up and we'll bill you for it. Your call. If you got the volunteers and you want to make this right and do right, if not, we're going to inspect it. And then they have a chance. Do they want to spend some of their concessions on the maintenance of the building, or they want to put their volunteers to work mopping and cleaning? You clean the bathrooms, we'll check it. If they're good, we're out. If you're dropping the ball, we'll clean them. Or if you don't want to clean bathrooms, we'll clean it. But there's a cost. We're not going to put the we'll work with you because we're going to need to do this. That would be the that would be the discussion premise direction that I would go. Now, if we want to step back and say, no, Little League does just fine, we don't have any obligation to support them, and in fact, if we can make a few bucks off these guys, we can support these other programs in our Parks and Rec. Well, that's a different discussion. I'm not saying that doesn't have merit, but we spend a lot of money on good things in the community that are Parks and Rec like things that if we ran out of money would be the first things we'd have to cut. They're important, they're valuable, but they're sort of luxuries. If we were cutting deep enough and it was now cops and firemen or public works and roads, we would maintain those critical issues over what would ultimately be described as a luxury. So I like helping Little League. I think that it's a good thing. I had kids that participated in it. It was expensive to participate in it then. I thought I was on the low side of the income at the time, but I've seen some numbers that say, no, you know, you're $80,000, $90,000, you're actually kind of in the meaty part. Yeah, there's some $250,000 and up wealthy folks, but there's some other folks in the lower side of it now trying to raise families and participate in Little League too. So I think for folks that are have three or four kids doing karate and piano lessons and ballet and, you know, 100 here, 100 here, 100 here, 500 here, it adds up. So I would be in favor of making sure we're not losing money. I don't think we need to lose money, but I'm not trying to make much off it either, because I think the money that they could put towards their program, keep their rates down for their users, for the kids and families that are participating, is better. When I was in the program, because of my stay-home mom raising the three kids on a cop salary, we weren't able to, we got in, we could do it, but actually we benefited from some other folks that said, no, we'll help out. Here's a bat for your kid. I'm buying my kid a new bat. You can have this old one. I'm like, oh, that bat's great. well, you know, if we're going to go do a practice or something. So there were some nice folks in the community that were blessed, and they continue and still, I'm sure, continue to do that. So that's my thoughts.
Just for consideration, last week I came to you and we discussed indoor facility rentals. So the space in the concession stand is about 341 square feet that they use. That's approximately half of our small community room at a rate of about $20 an hour if we were doing rate-to-rate comparison. So Little League last year used the concession stand $976 hours. And if we did the math, the rental rate at what we charge for our community rooms on a comparison would have been $19,520. And instead, they only paid $5,100. So even at a comparison for similar use availability and cost, we are giving them a significant savings off of what we are able to generally charge our community.
Well, with all due respect, I'm not sure that's a fair comparison. I mean, it's like pertinent to a baseball field. That building can't just be generally rented out. So I'm not sure that's an equivalent analogy to renting out space in an office building that is more fungible. So, but that leads to the other question I was going to ask. You suggested that because they're storing stuff there, which the city's charging them for, it's precluding other users from using it. Would soccer, I don't know if this is for staff or possibly Councilmember Todd, would soccer use it? I don't have an understanding of the soccer's use of that field. Do they use it for games or just practice?
So soccer, because of the nature of soccer, the spectators are on the field. The rule is no food on the field. So therefore, food at soccer games is a no-no at Mill Creek Sports Park. Now, can you stop the kids from having their oranges at halftime? No. So soccer pays somebody every weekend to go out there and check the field on Saturday at the end of Saturday games and on Sunday at the end of Sunday games to make sure that staff can't find any residue from any whatever out there. But therefore, they don't want to sell concessions. No, number one, they don't want to spend the volunteer time to do it. And soccer games are 45 minutes long. They're not 2 or 3 hours like a baseball game. So soccer doesn't want to be in the concession. First couple of years, the way the field was set up, the city had not made a policy decision to leave the lights on until 10 o'clock every night, whether it's being used or not. So if the soccer club or the baseball club was renting the field, when you were done, if you wanted to quit paying for the lights, you had to go upstairs and turn them off at the breaker panel. And so that was part of the early problem was, the league was in there, soccer had to go in there every day and turn off the lights. So again, soccer paid somebody to go and do that. But I think that's where this early thing came on. Little League's got their stuff all over, but soccer had to go in and out, turn the lights on and off. So anyway, I think soccer doesn't have a use for it.
What about the PA system? Do they use PAs for soccer games?
Soccer guys.
No, because you have to staff it, so soccer doesn't care to staff stuff like that. You don't announce at soccer games.
I'm talking about the concession stands. I mean, if we were just, we're talking about maybe if there's kind of part of the whole package. Sorry,
I'm talking. Yeah. I would think not. I haven't been involved in that soccer club bubble for quite a few years, but that
they were not interested in that. They've gotten out of the fundraising kinds of things. They've kept their costs low other ways, otherwise, and just fundraising has not been a... It takes a lot of volunteers to get very few dollars as their assessment. They used to run tournaments, and it isn't worth it. So...
So maybe here, what, for example, in 2018, what did the city take in fees and 15%?
It's all in here.
$5,100. That's everything all in.
And for the concession stand? Not for the concession stand.
Yeah.
And is that looking out at the budget for the budget?
No, this is the month.
It is. We budgeted based on the status quo.
But is it your position that we're losing money, or after time to maintain the light, the blah blah blah?
No, but just like the facility rentals here, all of these fees together help fund our recreation programs.
Oh, I get that.
Yeah,
that's not my question. I'm aware.
So we're not losing money. It's helping with our other recreation.
Well, I would not want us to lose money. That's my where I'm going.
Yeah.
So that's why I asked that question.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I'm not advocating this to be zero. What rubs me the wrong way is the percentage. I mean, to me, that's why I was asking the questions about the cost, and I appreciate your comments, Councilmember Bond, is it makes sense to me to have a flat rate to make sure we're not losing money. What that rate should be, it just rubs me the wrong way that it's charged based on a percentage, because that suggests we're just trying to be greedy and grab from the Little League.
If they don't make a lot of money that year, then oh well, we're still getting that 15%. But if they do great, okay, city maybe gets a little bit more to recoup their costs. I don't see it that way. Maybe you can explain a little more. I don't see how that would somehow prejudice the Little League in any way.
The argument that you would make to say we're going to bank some extra is because at the end of the day, they're never going to cover the replacement costs and the other big dollars. So, you know, is that field really just there for that? Or, again, is it our policy of saying, hey, we know we've got other programs, every extra dime helps, so fine. I mean, if that's our position, that's kind of where Joni's at, sort of. If I'm not putting words in your mouth, but, you know, it's a fair rate, we're getting a little, you know, we're making some money, and then there's other programs. Well, we're consistent with what we do with other projects, which renting space for a community room is a little different. This is just kind of an anomaly over there, but.
I mean, it's such a small amount of money, $5,100. It almost seems like it's ridiculous talking about it. I'm hoping you have other suggestions. I believe in support of the athletics. I think you made a very passionate plea last time when we were discussing that, and I'm open to whatever.
Not as much, and I just found out that my connection recently resigned. I don't know what happened, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's part of why I want to have this discussion, is I just want to know what the policy, I mean, when we say we're compensating, are we compensating for our costs, or are we saying we're going to compensate for our costs plus? So if you do well, we're going to have a little extra. I just want us to have a discussion so we're all on the same page of what it is we're doing and why.
Throw one more thought out. All
right,
go ahead.
Actually, you know, this is kind of an interesting discussion, because I sit here and I think to myself, I don't really have a dog in this hunt, but I do, because my kids were part of the Little League program, and I do remember it. But, you know, this is kind of a personal opinion, I think, is what we're getting into here, and that's why we're a little bit hard to debate on facts versus opinions. The park is fantastic, and the kids love playing there. The concessions offer a nice added feature. This is something we do for the Little League program and the soccer program in some respect, but primarily it's for the Little League program, and it's a great program, one of our true successes. I think it's great that we offer the concession stand. I think it's right to ask for some reimbursement from them for it, because, as Councilmember Bonds said, you're not going to cover the cost every year. There's, you know,
stones have to be repaired, things fall down, doors don't work anymore, they have to be replaced. There's ongoing costs. So we're not looking to get rich, and obviously at $5,100, this city will not get rich. That's not what we're talking about. My question is it fair? And you did your research on what other cities charge. I mean, we don't
charge them per game, which I think is fantastic. That would be crazy.
A monthly fee, no matter how many games they have, I think that's smart. It's just easier to maintain. The percentage, you know, there's a question of is that right? Ask them for a percentage of their sales. In a way, you've created this facility. What if they did a crummy job with it? What if they didn't bother to sell the food or stock the food or maybe somebody got sick or something?
They're motivated to generate more. They're not penalized for generating too much. I don't think what you're recommending is unfair. I think it's fair when I look at other cities, the research you did. I think it makes sense. It's
more the question of do we want to charge Little League for the concession business? One thought is shut the door down. Don't charge them anymore. Don't even have a concession stand there. We don't have to worry about it. But I think it is a nice treat. And I would like to see us keep that open. And I don't think the fees are unrealistic. I wouldn't be opposed to a cap if that was the case. They can't pay more than 10 grand a year or whatever, 7,500, I don't know. But, I think it's good, and I think your fees are fair. So my opinion, just I was happy with what we're doing and continue with what we're doing.
Percentage of it sales, I don't like it. It might be easy, but it lends itself to how are we policing them? How are we making sure that they're being honest? Are they being tempted to do, to not be honest? Did they just make an error? What's the consequences if they didn't give us their 15%? I don't want to spend in a bunch of money, spending dollars to collect nickels type thing. So I'd rather I like the flat fee thing. Also, I don't mind this at all. What staff did here is great. My only question was, do we have a different goal or premise? This is very practical, well thought out. Hey, this is kind of a way to collect fees. So here was the thing I was just going to say. It is only $5,000 at some level budget dust, but the seniors came in and said we could use $5,000, and nobody from Little League has come in and said beep. So maybe there isn't a problem, and I'm too removed from Little League to know if there is or isn't. So I just don't want to jam them up, but nobody's come in to say they're getting jammed up, so maybe it's just fine. I mean, they know where we are and they know when we meet.
Situation of that field and things that are flammable.
No, we would
prohibit it. I don't think that. Why would you want to have someone cook on a synthetic surface?
Bleachers behind the bleachers or outside of the concession stand. There's a big cement area. There's picnic tables there. Is there anything that would preclude them from pulling their stuff out in coolers and a barbecue and just doing it in the public area?
There could be fire regulations, depending on what they bring in there to cook. I still think it'd be a problem doing that in a synthetic surface field, even though they're not on the field.
I haven't suggested they do it. I'm just wondering.
Yeah, but I don't know. The direct answer to your question, I don't know what's in the code, but I think there's. It'd be good to have something in the code that would prevent that if we've had problems with it.
Well, so I'll leave it at. I would suggest, I like the ideas of either a cap on how much the 15% is or just set it at a flat rate. And it looks like we've averaged just under between 1,000 and 1,100 over 15 years. Oh, I went to all that effort and it's right there.
But you checked your number.
If I'd just gone to the bottom line, I would have seen it. Thank you for doing my work for me. It's been a long day. I've been up since 4.
Okay, Stephanie?
I kind of feel like we could go and give them a set fee every month, but by giving them a low fee and then basing any additional on how much they do sell, then if they don't sell anything that month, then they're not paying as much. So I actually look at this as a way to help them so that on months when they're not doing well or if it's a year where they don't do so well compared to another year, then they're not having to pay as much as they would have. Whereas if we just give them a flat fee, then on a year when people aren't buying as much for concessions, they're still paying that fee and they're not making as much money.
And you can see in the numbers on page 2 and 3 of the agenda summary where there was a drop between 2014 and 2015, a significant drop, and that reflects exactly the same case because they were out of commission due to a fire. So we adjusted the fees accordingly. Instead of where the trend had been upward with the Little League over a couple of years, the fees reduced significantly to accommodate exactly that situation.
For the kids and not just is.
A year?
The month.
We just ran over Stephanie. Were you done?
I was done.
Okay, so do you have any thoughts about that?
Really, I'm fine with that. We are at 1,100. I'm sorry. Well, right now we've been under that for a while.
To exceed X number of dollars per month. I like that. I could support that.
Average has been.
I can absolutely do that as a motion for next week, perhaps, because Little League is eager. They are asking us for the contract.
Thank you for the discussion.
Thank you.
Okay. Item E, Bob.
Yes. So, Mayor and Council, this was a topic that we discussed the first or second meeting in January, prompted by the discussion that was held when you adopted the 19-20 budget. You remember the Mill Creek Senior Center had asked for an additional, council directed an additional $2,500 to be provided to the Mill Creek Senior Center and a one-time contribution in addition to the $12,500 that you had already proposed and now adopted in the budget. So this contains the same information that was presented to you in January, a report that was compiled that primarily evaluated King County cities and the human services per capita amounts that they provide, includes some information, although limited, on what cities provide in Snohomish County. The new information that council asked for during that meeting in January was what the city has provided in terms of human services providers or social service providers in the past. And so I provided that to you as an attachment. It's fairly limited. That included Rotary, and this is based on records that we have available here at City Hall that go back to year 2000, so anything that occurred prior to then, I'm not able to share that with you this evening, but the city had provided in total $1,700 or $1,750 to the Rotary. Of course, the North Shore Senior Center, you know about $12,500. That has changed over the years. Just for example, since 2007, you've been providing $12,500 per year, but prior to that, in 2006, in 2005, 4, and 3, it was $7,500 a year. 2002 was $6,000, and 2001 was $5,000, and when you started it in 2000, it was $1,000. So you have climbed it up a bit since its inception in 2000. Also included was the Mill Creek for Youth, which was called the Malt Shop. I think this was in existence or just had terminated at the time that I arrived here initially as the city manager, so there are really no records that we could find in terms of the amount that was funding for that youth activity or for that drop-in youth center. And then the last was just money that you're obligated to provide, all cities are obligated to provide to the counties, which is 2% of your liquor profits and excise taxes, which in Mill Creek's case is about $5,500 annually. So if just sort of running the math on a per capita basis, if you would call this group here the human services funding that you provide, the $12,500 plus the $5,500 annually, it's a little less than a dollar per capita that you're providing for human services as a comparison against what many of the other cities in King County consistently have provided. Very few in Snohomish County, of course, have provided that type of funding. Although I would note that From the report that was provided in the packet, the city of Linwood does provide human services funding at a per capita amount just below $5.
Last year, that Councilmember Barnes
If there's a human service provider on there regarding health of the community, a direct allocation to the health district of any particular county, I'm not sure that many would categorize that as human services funding. Again, these would be more than not, they would be private 501(c) type groups and independent from a county government or a city government. The same argument or the same analogy could be made. Many cities fund domestic violence coordinators and programs, but you also would see those same programs funded under human services to the extent they were outside of what the city is providing or outside what the county government is providing. And so I think the same would be true for health district issues as well. Just as a comparison, I looked at some reports in King County and Snohomish County to get an idea of King County, for whatever reason, is just funding more human services in Snohomish County. On a per capita basis, or at least population basis, King County is three times larger than Snohomish County, of almost 2 million population versus 900,000 in Snohomish County. Yet King County funds human services, the county government, funds human services more than three times greater than Snohomish County funds human services. So,
how much of that is voter-approved? Because they are constantly...
I don't know. These are total funds with grant funds. It could be levy funds. Certainly, obviously, King County, greater density would likely cause then more need for human services. And, of course, they have homelessness as a major initiative that they fund. And so you would expect that a larger urban area would have more human services funding and needs than a smaller, not to say that Snohomish County is small by any means, but in comparison to King County, it's at least three times as small or smaller.
We pay additional money through the mental health sales tax. That's something that we pay for. Everybody does. But I just think I'd like to know how many of those King County human services payments are actually voter-approved levies, because that's not all coming out of their general fund like our money does.
Right. And
they go out there, and it seems like every election there's another ballot measure.
My analysis today was just a quick review of how much King County pays versus Snohomish County. And remember, we got into this discussion because of the request from additional funds from the senior center, and then we broadened it out to other community service, human services needs. And so that was the information that we were able to collect for council's direction and consideration tonight.
Yeah, and one of the things that you and I had talked about was, we had money in the council contingency, and this came up when I was suggesting that perhaps we could plow the roads in the neighborhood that is pretty out, that with overtime and everything, we don't know yet how much money we actually have. And you suggested that we do a budget amendment, that maybe that would be the appropriate time to do it.
You could certainly do the human services funding at that time, as well as we look at sort of our after action report with respect to the last storm event, if you want to do more preparation for storm events with equipment or staffing. The time to do that would be at the mid-biennium review, when you have a better idea of what your revenue situation is compared against your expenses, rather than, the third month into the biennium.
Councilmember Todd, then Cavallari.
Similar, and then
suddenly switched to some Orange County cities and a lot of them were nothing. I was wondering, I'm like, what's the difference? So thank you, city manager, for looking at the difference between Orange County and King County, because I was speculating if there's something different fundamentally about what we're addressing. And it must just be historical or density driven or things like that. As the mayor points out,
it's both.
Driven by Seattle and their
problems and issues and attitudes and voter coupons. So that's, I agree, there's some apples and oranges here. But I think the fundamental question we're looking at is, what should we be doing? And this is not an easy question, but it revealed to me there's a lot of cities of our size, not just the big Bellevues and Tacomas and the Seattles and Everetts, that are funding various programs that are called human services. And so I'm kind of scratching my head and saying, well, what should we be doing? You look at our own community a couple of years ago, school district brought to our attention that there's a lot of kids on free and reduced price lunches, and that turned into an initiative to start a Mill Creek Food Bank. And thankfully, Rotary stepped up and said, we'll put some time and energy into this. The school district could provide some space for it. A lot of volunteers came out of the woodwork. And so we kind of addressed that human services need without the cities. The city participated in that, but the city didn't have to put a lot of dollars into it to make it happen. Just did some facilitation. So it's kind of neat that our community stepped up. There's other service groups that I think are doing things like that. So we're blessed with having those local service groups that are stepping up and doing some of these things. Whereas you can see some of these other communities probably had to do something because nobody else was going to do it. I'm not proposing to spend a lot more money. I'm not into spending more money. But I think we're looking at not just one-time money out of council contingency. That's our piggy bank, but it's not a continuous funding source. There's no money goes in. We can fix little problems one-off out of our council contingency. But I think the bigger question for us, and not to solve it tonight, but to say what's important with respect to our vision, mission, values, goals for the city, what's important for us to do as a city, and how do we deal with people who come in and say, I'd like $1,000 or $10,000 or whatever for my program or my project. How do we respond to those? I think that's what we wanted to talk about, give staff some guidance so everything isn't just a one-off, how do we feel today kind of thing. Thanks.
I reviewed them as well, and what struck me is kind of what you pointed out, that a lot of cities are down south are doing a lot more and addressing it directly and specifically. Some of the things I do, we agree that this is kind of the fluff, the above and beyond what we've already budgeted, a little extra here and there. Taking a spin off some of the cities that incorporate their language, Puyallup, really, if you want to take a look at it, Puyallup has a great little system in place that it seems that they have put together that works for them. I don't agree with their dollar figures or percentages, but the appointment of a three council member panel deciding on a yearly basis, deciding how much we have a small pot of money that's maybe a little bit of fluff, they decide, they present it to the full council votes on it, and it's repetitive every year. You can't, it's not assumed to carry over the next year. You have to apply for it again. I really like the nuts and bolts of that Puyallup language if we want to look at something like that as a reference point. I think that would work here and solves everybody's problem. So this initially started because I think the mayor said she wanted a policy in place regarding any sort of future payments to groups. So anyway, take a look at that. Let me know what you think. I think we could easily put a good spin off of that for our city. Thanks.
Councilmember Stecker.
Just a thought.
And I did see some music together to figure out this if you want to put it. Yeah, the question of money like this, who's going to ask this for? I'd like for Councilmember Stecker to talk about, we have a mission and vision for our city. We have certain elements that are important to us. Maybe what we really need to do is put together a list of criteria or elements that we would like to enhance in our city. In other words, if somebody's going to ask for money,
how do we evaluate that as opposed to, gee, I love this personal event, or, oh, that's really important to me, or, no, put all that aside, just say, how does it hit, let's evaluate everybody the same, on the same criteria, how does this investment help us achieve some community goals or social goals, or however, I don't know what the criteria would be, but maybe a small group of council could put that together. But so that when
somebody comes in, everybody's evaluated the same. They're not evaluated on the, I mean, I love seniors.
Yeah, I'd like to say I love them and they hit the criteria of why we want to invest more money in them. Or youth, our kids, I love youth. Our kids want some, for a new senior youth center or something. I just think maybe if we set some criteria for us to evaluate on a level playing field, it would be it might be a lot easier. Just a thought.
It'll be the mid-biennium review is typically September, October, November time frame.
Okay, we should already have a city manager on. So maybe we can sit down and maybe we have a committee, maybe it's a committee of the whole, but we need to have some standards. And that was my concern. Then once we do, whether it's three people once a year sitting down and coming up with stuff like we did the scholarship, or other things, just as long as we have something that we can say. And I think that would be very helpful. And I too appreciate all the work that went into this. It's just amazing.
Council Member Bond, and then Todd.
Speaking for myself, very few of my friends have shown up and I don't have any trouble telling them no. And I would tell them no before they got here so that it wouldn't waste their time. And I would tell them why. It's not because I don't love you. It's not because I don't care about you. It just doesn't make sense. And this is what we're competing with. And this is what you're if I give dollars to this bucket suffers, and I can't do that. And it's not a level playing field. I mean, it'd be nice if it was. These decisions would be easy. These seniors are going to continue to be a priority for me. And I will acknowledge that I am probably influenced significantly by my grandfather and my grandmother, 101. Grandpa passed away, but Grandma's still kicking. My father, who's suffering from dementia at 76, and my mom, who cares for him at 75. And I hear them talk, and I hear their friends talk. They've paid taxes their whole life. They've been good citizens, and they feel neglected. They feel forgotten. My dad has all the same challenges of an infant and none of the cuteness. And it's easy to just ignore him. He's difficult, it's ugly, and it's sad, and I don't want to deal with it. And I don't want to leave my mom to deal with it. This is going to get worse. We are getting older. We haven't figured out this Alzheimer's dementia thing. Some of the seniors are going to have lots of money, and they're going to pour it into these programs, and they're going to, like the good folks that carried Little League. Some of them aren't going to have it. My parents are very fixed income, very modest in what they're able to do. And if my dad gets sick enough, it will wipe them out. And my mom is scared. So what's this going to do to her? Is she going to be 101 like my grandma? Because there ain't going to be money to be there if my dad has long-term care issues over the next, say, 10 or 15 years. But even besides those things, just the day-to-day quality of life of groups where I had a friend, 45-year-old guy, died. Deputy sheriff, detective, passed away. Maybe a little, I'm not entirely exact, he's a little younger than me. And I got another deputy friend of mine, a couple years older than me, in hospice, and he's going to die. This group of seniors, their friends die. They need to go and make new friends. If they're blessed with longevity, they've buried a lot of friends. My parents have buried a lot of friends. My grandma, I don't think, has any friends left. I mean, she's like it. Seniors are important. It's not a level playing field. That's just saying. Sorry. Thanks for listening. I got myself on this.
Odd than Holtzclaw? Programs at the senior center that are recreational programs, just like we have rec programs for other ages, and the city is elected to do kid programs and adult programs, you know, learn how to babysit, learn how to paint, learn how to whatever. Those programs, we've kind of set up things that we're going to provide space to those programs. We're going to make sure we make enough money to cover our costs, but we're not going to compete with the private sector, but people are going to pay what it costs to go to those classes. And I would contend some of the programs that our seniors participate in through our senior center are similar to that. But there are programs over there that are helping people who don't have the financial means or the connections as they age or the medical attention or just the companionship that's required. And those are things where I think we should be looking to help to make sure those kinds of programs that are not recreation, they are quality of life things for our seniors are appreciated. And it's hard to, I don't really want to divide it all down, but I think we've got to think about both kinds of things over there. So some of those things are for fun, and I think folks can participate in paying for the fair share cost of those things. Other things I think are things we need to figure out how we fund them. And we already fund the seniors at a level in terms of dollars and in terms of space that we're providing for them, so that's great. Comment that was made earlier, we've got to be careful. I like the idea of having a ad hoc group of citizens and council people and staff that get together and evaluate grant proposals. But you got to be careful you don't set somebody up for failure. Somebody who says, hey, I got $5,000 from the city of Mill Creek this year and next year, and then you don't give it to them the year after that. That's devastating to these small programs. So you got to be careful what you get started and you can continue. And we've heard that before from the seniors, senior center in particular, is that, hey, we're stuck with these things that are in place. We don't want to cut programs. If you don't continue the funding level you gave us last year, we're going to be in trouble. So we got to be careful how we, what we like to put on our list and how we make sure it's a continuous funding stream for them so they can make, they can count on that as well. Thanks.
Thank you. No, I was going to say, I'm not sure I'll still be here the next time you have this discussion, so I'll just leave you with a couple of thoughts. I know there's need here in Mill Creek, and I know that because BAFA ran the Single Human Services funding that Puyallup ran in terms of the process, where there's a grant application that was put out, and then there's always more demand and more need than the resources. BAFA funded things at about $7 per capita. And there's always greater need than that, and that's just a next-door city. So I'm sure that if you created a pot of funding and then made application, you would get requests for that funding. And so I think the key policy issues for you are, what are the critical human service needs that are not being met by others? How can you fill that gap? And you can approach funding that way, or you can approach funding by determining hopes that you believe that you can contribute towards that cause, and that could be a per capita amount. And so once you answer two of those, I think you have already enough demand for those funds in this community, just because I think it's not because there's not the means to understand. I think there just hasn't been the culture, and there hasn't been the process established by me and the communities to make those funds available.
Health and the mental health funding, and they don't look like social services. A lot comes through the sheriff's department.
True, but I think some of the counties doing the same thing, but they're more established in terms of having a process and advertising that. Many communities have seen the report, although they started off individually making grant applications to their own communities, they've gone towards more of a regional approach, because services and demand cuts across political boundaries. And so rather than each individual entity doing a human services grant application process, many of them have gone to a collection of a regional approach for dividing that money up. So thoughts to consider for you in the future.
Can we make sure that this is on a calendar?
Yeah.
Don't want it to slip because we're busy with other things.
We'll do so on those issues, yes.
I'm thinking
the South County mayor, the North County mayor, they're kind of ad hoc. But would this be an interesting topic? It looks like came down to a bunch of people that said, gee, we all need to have our own consortium together. I wonder if there's other cities having these same thoughts, and if there's South County cities among the consortium, or at least coming to each other. I know the community has stepped up. They're as a bigger community. Larger city and
more money,
lots of sales tax money, which will be the biggest money to spend, but they had more human services kind of issues because of population. So they had to step up. The rest of us have not done it. But I wonder if there's lessons to be learned or ways to work together. Because you're right, it's not the person on this side of the third, it's the person on the other side of the third that's still like a Mill Creek issue potentially for some of these.
Need
some kind of help. And so I would hold it to the
county to sure that the other citizens should know this too.
Okay.
So I'm going to
thank you.
Okay, so next up is the consent agenda, City Council meeting minutes of November 6, 2018, and City Council meeting minutes of November 13, 2018. Do
you
have a motion for the consent agenda?
Motion to approve. Second.
Do you have a motion and a second?
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, abstentions passing unanimously.
And Bob and Gina are working hard to get caught up on the, we're way behind, and we certainly need our minutes caught up. So they're working on it. Next
up,
reports. And just so everybody knows, we have an executive session.
No report,
Mayor.
Apologize for not having a mic on my last comments. City meeting. The good news is they're short. The bad news is they're short because all the presenters, for the most part, weren't able to be there. So the agenda was cut in half. The one thing that was presented was Chris Collier from the Alliance for Housing Affordability, who just gave a brief presentation on the projects they've been involved with, and talk about adding things to the calendar and human services. I would suggest to our interim city manager that we consider having him come in just to give us a brief 5 or 10 minute presentation. I know he's done it with other cities on what the Alliance for Housing Affordability does and some of the housing affordability issues that are going on in the county.
Be about 15 minutes. Start the clock.
Long-term growth plan for. Right there, thank you. And click where to get the next slide. Right there. So Vision 2040 has been the plan, and it's been all about the economy and the environment and urban growth strategy, and all the cities in the four-county region participate in that. They're in the process of starting Vision 2050. They started a couple years ago, and by 2020 they'll have an adopted plan. A couple things I want to throw at you here. So right now we're about 4.1 million people in the Puget Sound area. They're forecasting that we get 5.8 million people, another 1.7 million people by 2050. And if you look at that, that means like another 9,000 people on top of the 20,000 we already have in Mill Creek. So that's a lot of folks.
How many counties?
Four counties.
Four.
Snohomish, King, Pierce, and Kitsap are in our Metropolitan Planning Organization, part of PSRC. Looking at jobs, a lot of jobs growth too, and this is what's going on. So is the projection wrong? Could be, but it's still a lot of people. They talked about who's going to be living here. We talked about older. They're saying region-wide, we're going to 18% of the region's population be over the age of 65 by 2050. Just saw this thing about the silver tsunami. It says Snohomish County is going to be 21%. Our city's already above that, and so we're going to see older households. We're going to see more diverse households throughout the region, and they're saying smaller households. As people get older, households get smaller, and people are choosing to be in smaller households. And so you end up needing about 830,000 more housing units for those folks by 2050. 800,000. And we're talking about whether we put 200 or 300 or 400 apartments in on at the farm. So that's my political comment. So I'm going to click on this and let the presentation. So Paul Ingram is the guy who gave this presentation down there, and it's going to pick up from here because he can do it better than I can.
Address climate, jobs, issues of health and equity. There's been a number of different issues that have come up about managing the unincorporated urban area. How do we support annexations of those areas? And also, how do we address accountability and incentives? How do we implement the plan once we have it adopted and make sure that we're all doing our part individually? So let's jump to growth alternatives. We have our current growth strategy, which really focuses on how do we get growth to occur within the urban area and within our cities and within our regional growth centers. How do we support our rural areas to remain rural and keep the functioning of our ag lands and our forest lands? And how do we better coordinate between transportation and land use? So that's our current growth strategy. It's done pretty well, if you will. That's not a technical term, but we've had a lot of successes in implementing the growth strategy, recognizing that because of the recession, the legislature delayed the comp plan updates. So we adopted Vision 2040 in 2008. The first plans that were adopted were in 2015. So we had a big delay in adopting local plans, but nonetheless, there's a lot of progress made over the last decade in working towards our growth strategy, and certainly there's more time for that to continue. We organize around geographies of cities rather than trying to, we don't specify targets for individual cities. That occurs at the countywide level. We work with geographies so that there's groups of cities, and that provides a broader framework to help inform those target process. We have the metropolitan cities, Seattle, Bellevue, Everett, Tacoma, Bremerton. Core cities are those with regional growth centers. Those haven't changed. You may recall there is a lot of discussion about what's the difference between a small city and a larger city. Those somewhat arbitrary terms. So those are proposed to go away. They get replaced with high-capacity transit communities, which includes the cities and portions of the unincorporated urban area, such as in southwest Snohomish County, that are directly served by different forms of frequent transit. We have other cities and towns that aren't part of that high-capacity transit network, other portions of the unincorporated urban area. We have rural resource lands, as we have had before, and now directly calling out major military installations as part of those regional geographies. We don't assign a growth to major military installations because they operate differently, let's just say, but we are recognizing them as a type of geography. So with that, using those geographies, we have three different alternatives. Stay the course, takes Vision 2040, adds 10 years to it, using the same type of growth allocation that we have today, and moving that forward. Transit focused growth says, how do we better leverage the transit investments that we've made, either that are already built or that we've committed to financially? And reset urban growth tries to maybe take more of a reality lens of what have been some of the trends that have occurred, what are some of the capacities within our communities. So I'll go through those in just a little bit more detail. So staying the course, as I said, it continues that current strategy. How do we really focus a lot of our growth in those cities with regional growth centers, the metropolitan and the core cities, and having somewhat less growth in urban unincorporated and rural areas? Transit-focused growth, as I said, it really looks to, okay, how can we take that strategy but better leverage the high-capacity transit network? And that includes BRT, includes ferries. So the investments Kitsap County is making in the fast ferries is reflected in this, as well as light rail and Sounder. And it says, well, what if we put 75% of that growth, that 1.8 million people, put that around these high-capacity transit stations? What would that look like, and how would that function? And we also reduce some of the growth in the rural and unincorporated areas that don't have that high-capacity transit service. Also, a difference with this and the next alternative is that it uses a more up-to-date version of the state OFM's county distribution shares, and it shifts 5% of the employment growth to Pierce, Snohomish, and Kitsap County, really hearing a lot of discussion with the Growth Management Policy Board about how do we ensure that we're getting jobs distributed in the region. So they wanted to emphasize a better balance of jobs distribution. So that's included within this alternative. RESA urban growth is one that's a little bit more trends-based. It still has the majority of, or the largest portion of its growth going to our largest cities, the metropolitan core cities. But it uses a capacity of some of our smaller cities and urban areas and essentially kind of fills up those areas to their capacities and has a little bit more growth going into the rural and some of the other unincorporated areas. So it's a bit more distributed. In some ways, it is still very similar to Stay the Course because the largest portion of the growth is still going into those largest cities. It also, like the prior alternative, uses the more up-to-date county shares and redistributes 5% of the employment to try to get a better balance of jobs. So how do these perform? We've just been going through a lot of internal modeling work and a lot of analysis, and we've partnered with Parametrics, and Parametrics helped us put together this document, and it's going to take a little while to kind of sort through all this. I just have a few highlights. There's some things that are common to all these alternatives that, from a congestion standpoint, people living closer and more within our urban environment means drive times shorten and distances are less, but we still have an increase in congestion overall. Transit ridership more than doubles as that transit network gets built out. Due to changes in the fleet and improvements in transit, we reduce pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. As I said, we need a lot more housing. And as redevelopment occurs, it continues to put pressure on displacement of some of our low-income populations today. And that's something that we'll have to work to mitigate regardless of alternative.
So he's got a couple more slides there on, let me bring this back down over to here. A couple more slides you can take a look at. But the point I wanted to make here is if you look at this right there, the unincorporated urban growth area, that's the area between Mill Creek and Linwood and Everett and Mukilteo, that has not performed the way they expected it to in terms of growth. This is what they expected. This is what they wanted it to be, expected to be, and this is what happens. A lot of the growth has gone here in the small cities where we were in the rural have done those kinds of things. They're saying that we're going to recategorize that to look at transit-focused areas instead of small and large in here. And we are a transit-focused area. So when they start talking about taking more growth and putting it into the transit, into the high-capacity transit communities, that Reed Mill Creek, Reed South Snohomish County, everything around here with light rail coming and BRT coming is going to have an impact on us. So what they're headed for, here's the bottom line. They've got these themes they're looking at for the policies they're going to put into place. This whole thing is under what sounds stuffy, and it is. It's the SEPA process. Oh, who's going to go to a public hearing about the SEPA process on Vision 2050? Well, the answer is this is our time as a city and as a county to stand up and say what's important to us in terms of growth, because what gets put into the plan will impact a lot of different things. So they're right here in the middle of this, right here in March 2019. 60-day comment period got started last Thursday. It's going to last for a couple of months, and they're going to select one of these preferred alternatives. If I would let him keep talking, he says it's probably not one or two or three. It's not A or B or C. It's going to be some mixture of those things. And so they're looking for public comment from the public as a whole and from cities and the counties about it. And so there's a meeting going on next Tuesday, March 12th, in Edmonds is close, but that's we're overlapping with our city manager things, but in the 18th in Bothell, there's one that's close by. Stephanie is the one that's signed up so far, is going to the Vision 2050 for Snohomish County thing that's going on March 21st. It's a joint meeting between SCC and SCT. If you can get to that, I encourage you to go. Both staff and council should go to that, because that's where we, Snohomish County, are going to talk about what are we going to do with all the people that are going to get added to Snohomish County. Like it or not, they're coming here. This is our chance to influence it. So that's the bottom line. Get the word out about those public meetings and think about it. And if you can go to that meeting, go for it. $15
for the refreshments. I apologize. I don't know about it. I really would like to be there. I'm going to be across the state at the TLB meeting. Hopefully I get some complete streets money, but we'll see how that goes, too.
Okay. Before you sit down, would you mind giving us a brief update on House Bill 1923? Can you get on top of that, or somebody's going to do that, because we're to the point where we probably should take some action.
Which bill is that?
Bob, were you going to talk about
that? Yeah, so House Bill, if now is an appropriate time.
Yeah, okay, I want to make a comment on this. Mike is right. As a city, I mean, Councilmember Brown hit on this in some comments at the study session last week. With land use, when it comes to individual projects, the challenge always is the decisions are made at the comp plan process, and by the time the land use sign goes up, there's nothing that can be done anymore. This is analogous for us, because once PSRC sets the regional plan, then all the county's comp plans have to be consistent with the regional plan, and our comprehensive plan has to be consistent with, it trickles up. And so if we have issues or concerns with the strategies that they're proposing, we need to get in on it now. We could talk for hours about Vision 2040 and whether it has been successful or not, but talk to Everett. Everett had a big beef with the PSRC because the 2040 plan shoved a lot of growth there that they did not want and could not accommodate. So there's a lot of pie in the sky that ends up going into this plan, and I should get a soapbox that I can keep here and some social engineering. But the point is, we need to be involved as a city and comment on this, because once the decisions are made on that plan, our hands are tied.
2050 seems like...
So House Bill 1923 is a bill that I think Councilmember Todd has remarked about. We've talked about it previously. It's been mentioned a couple times by Association of Washington Cities. It's a bill that promotes density and affordability in cities. In general, this bill and others like it, although they may have some good policy issues or promotion of good policy, it does start to erode the decision-making ability of the individual municipalities to make these decisions. And that's certainly what 1923 does. In particular, 1923 requires a couple of things to be done by year 2022 by each city. One would be that you allow accessory dwelling units in single-family zone districts, which you already do now, so that's not a significant issue for the city. Another is that it requires you to set a zoning amount of 50 units, dwelling units per acre, if you're within 1/4 mile of a transit station as defined by RCW 9.91025. Light rail, for example, would be the closest station to Mill Creek, which would be in Linwood, would be outside the 1/4 mile, but something, of course, could happen in the next 10, 15, 20 years, potentially that would change that. So you would adopt that as in your code, but it's not going to have a practical impact because you're outside of that 1/4 mile. The provision that would probably have an impact with you would be affordable housing. And although there's some merits behind the affordable housing, again, it starts to take away or erode the local decision-making. And it requires that you to do two or three things. One is that you adopt an inclusionary zoning program, meaning that in this case it requires that 10% of any of your new housing capacity be directed or to accommodate affordable housing. Second, again, you have to pick two or three of these, that any surplus property or provides that surplus property to be used in for affordable housing pursuant to the statute. What's not clear to me, and I have to look further at that statute, if that would allow you to dispose of property for other community benefit purposes, economic development purposes, et cetera, or if it always has to go to affordable housing. And the third option, again, two or three, is to enact an affordable housing levy pursuant to the statute. So those are three things that deal with affordable housing that will likely have more impact to an implication for Mill Creek than would the first two because, again, light rail stations outside the 1/4 mile, and you already allow for ADUs in your single-family zones.
BRT, that affects, so it's not just the light rail thing, the light rail station, but doesn't it also affect?
We're finding RCW 9.91.025, and I thought that was limited to not the BRT stations, but the light rail station, which would be the closest one to be limited, but we can certainly... does 1920? I didn't drill down far enough to determine if 1923 is impacting mitigation dollars.
There's a lot of stuff. So what this is the cities have gone down. Workforce housing, missing middle people talk about, we do really well with high-rises downtown Seattle, we do really well with single-family dwellings in Monroe or Arlington, but the missing middle that's affordable to folks who are working and don't want to drive for 2 hours to get to it is missing. So AWC, a lot of the cities and the counties have said, hey, we need help with this. And so the state came back with this. It's kind of a blunderbuss approach that says, well, if you want affordable housing, we'll tell you how to do it. By 2022, you won't be able to get any money from us to put a fund or other things. teeth in this are pretty severe. Bob talks about a quarter mile within light rail. Yeah, light rail Linwood's to begin with, but guess what? Our urban growth boundary goes over to Ash Way and goes over to 128th, where there's going to be two light rail stations. So 50 dwelling units per acre, somewhere there, we don't know exactly where the stations are going to be, but it's going to happen. And so we've heard people come into this chamber last week and before say, I can't even get across the highway to 128th. They're not going to be happy when they see the kind of densities are going to go in here. There's things in here, too, that says if you have affordable housing, senior housing, disabled folks housing, they're going to have restrictions on zero parking stalls. You know, if you're within transit, I think this is where what Mayor Pruitt says, I think if you're within a BRT line, they're going to mandate that we have zero parking stalls for units within a quarter mile of a BRT. That may not be so good. So we may have the little details a little bit messed up here, but this is not good for cities. I would propose having Bob at least write something generic that helps support AWC and saying this is not something that Mill Creek's in favor of. AWC is trying real hard to get this toned down or changed to something different. It's right now it's squeezing through the process. That's not good for us.
We could actually do a letter like that we've done this in the past and have all the council members sign it to show that we're not happy.
If we're clear, we need to find a place where the 0.8 million people are going to go over the next 20, 30 years. And it's not debating the merits of these policy implications, but again, relying upon local governments to make those decisions and giving local government your own city as to where your direct growth has been a path that cities have taken for many years, and this would erode a lot of that.
That's where's my soapbox, and I'm trying. I hear the idea that we need to have local discretion, but quite frankly, it's causing the GMA to suffer death by a thousand cuts. The example I use is the great disability. And so, if we let extra jurisdiction as a civil to restrict housing, that forces it to pop up somewhere. So right now, Sammamish has a moratorium on development. One of the hottest real estate markets for the east side has had a moratorium on development. That's local discretion, local control. Good thing, right? Well, no. That just puts pressure on the rest of King County and Sammamish County to absorb that growth. And I can point to examples of cities around the Puget Sound where it's ADUs in Seattle. It's the Point Wells project over in Shoreline. It's the moratorium in Sammamish. We need to be careful what we ask for, because the local discretion is going to keep us from getting to that accommodation of 1.8 million people. So I don't know what the answer is, but it's a fine line between excuse me, accommodating them and not. So some of those, I mean, I agree, there's some things in there that just don't make sense, but you know, if we're not going to push for density along the transit lines, then I mean, let's give up.
Yeah.
And I had to make a comment, one more, I'm sorry, on part of that presentation. You know, we designated a lot of the county as an urban growth area. And now they're trying to distinguish. So that's where we're supposed to put the growth. But now they're saying, well, we don't want it there, even though it's an urban growth area, because it's unincorporated, because we don't have transit. Well, you know why there's not transit there? That's right. The residents in those areas who hate growth vote against the annexation to community transit so that they don't get the more density. There's a complete disalignment between the transit service areas and the urban growth boundaries. So it's great to say let's put transit or put the growth where transit is, but people use it as a weapon to keep the growth from occurring. So I'm going to bring a soapbox next time. I'm familiar with a bunch of the bills, but I haven't read 1923, so I don't know all that's in it.
I can certainly draft a letter, send that out to council, and then whatever input you have, if you can get back to me as quickly as possible this week preferably, and then we can send something out, either collect signatures if you're all in favor of it, or if enough of you are in favor of it, then I can send it under my signature. I think it has more weight, carries more weight, certainly, if it's if I'm sending it on behalf of the city council. But you need to see it first. And I think it'll be along the lines of just preserving local decision-making, or at least more control than what the bill probably offers today. And probably pick up some of the language of AWC.
We can pick up some of the words that Brian said here. We appreciate that it needs to be done with the Metropolitan Planning Organization, and our county needs to figure out how to get it. One city doing stuff just squeezes the balloons. But if we collectively can say we've got a coordinated approach, rather than the state mandating approach, I guess the state mandating is what we're not in favor of. It's a coordinated approach. It's tough, but it would be better. What could be simpler? It sounds like an easy memo.
Yeah, clear as mud. Yes.
Barbara Heidel, 1401 144th Place, Mill Creek. A couple comments I'd like to make. First, about the discussion, which was very interesting, about the community funding. I sort of felt like it was aimed at me a bit for what I had presented about the senior center. I liked the ideas initially. I'd have to think about it a bit more, that Councilmember Steckler brought forward about a committee and certain standards. You have to be careful with seniors because it is a little bit different process, as Councilmember Bond was mentioning. At some point, you all hopefully are going to be reaching senior citizen age, and then it might feel a bit more important to you. Not that you're saying it's not important, but you come from a different perspective when you're almost there or are there. So it's a very interesting discussion, and I appreciate the discussion for all services that might come to ask for funds, not just the seniors. I'd like to make a quick comment also about the mics. I'm sorry I caused so much stress about the mics. I just want to make sure, and I appreciate your awareness that the mics are or are not on or aren't working. I do have a major concern because I do try to listen in addition, because I sometimes forget some of the things discussed because I don't take all notes. And so I like to go back and listen to the audio, and I'm missing pieces of it at times. So that's the only reason I'm turned it plus. I'll be missing some meetings. But I do appreciate that you do care and you want to keep everything transparent, which is what you've said in the goals. So thank you.
Anybody else? Scott, how much time have you got? 10 minutes?
Yeah, we're hoping for up to 15 minutes.
I'll make it fast. John Raymer, 831 148th Street Southeast here in Mill Creek. I want to thank the council very much personally as a veteran for passing the resolution to adopt the USS Ralph Johnson. Like your son, Councilman Bond, I have been on the receiving end of a city adopting my unit, and I was many thousands of miles away from home, and it was extremely gratifying that the citizenry took me in for Christmas and Thanksgiving and invited me out for parties and stuff. So it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Councilman Todd, I can assure you the impact to the staff will be very minimal because I'm volunteering my time to run the program for the city. So anything you need, I may come to you and say, hey, I got somebody who wants to come to your house for Thanksgiving. Please say yes. Cool. And the captain of the ship, Commander Mahone, has sent a note to me saying that he would like to, with the passing of the resolution, he would like to give the city council what's called a first plank. It's a very special award for a first crew of a ship. It's a part of the ship itself, and he wants to give it to the council. And his training schedule is open for next Tuesday. So, Bob, if I can pass a note to you, and hopefully we can get everything to give you guys a plaque at the beginning of next council. Just for a couple minutes, the captain and a couple of his crew members will be by. Thank you very much.
Okay, so now we're going to have a discussion, Scott.
Yes, for up to 15 minutes under RCW 4230.110.1I, potential litigation.
Could you have
no action is anticipated.
So it's 8:15.
High level, don't want to erode local control, preserve local control. Maybe there's an answer that has to be.